Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. British Prime Minister Theresa May is expected to trigger Article 50 today as the Scottish First Minister announces her intention to organize another independence referendum. As Britain steps into the unknown, what's next for the country and the EU? A deepening diplomatic crisis between Turkey and several European governments, including the Netherlands, continues. As rallies are banned and accusations of Nazism fly, how far will this escalate? South Korean politics and the geopolitics of East Asia have been scrambled by the impeachment of ex-president Park Geun-hye. Will the next president pursue a thaw in relations with the North, with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea? But first we turn to Theresa May announcing the process of beginning Britain's withdrawal from the EU. We are joined from the UK by John White. He is a political analyst and the host of Radio Sputnik's weekly show, Hard Facts. Welcome back, John.
Hi, Brian. It's good to be with you again.
Thank you for joining. Theresa May could trigger Article 50 as soon as today. What comes next?
Well, the latest reports actually are that she's going to delay triggering it. She's given herself until the end of March. But the amendments that were suggested by the House of Lords last week to the Brexit bill, which is the main one being the guarantee of citizen rights to the 3 million EU citizens currently resident in the UK, they've been rejected by the Parliament, so that clears the way for Theresa May to go ahead and trigger Article 50, which is the mechanism which begins the formal process of departing the EU. But this political crisis has taken a new turn with the announcement of the leader of the Scottish National Party, Nicola Sturgeon, and the First Minister of the devolved Scottish Government yesterday, which has preempted the latest developments at Westminster, that she is now going to seek approval, which she will undoubtedly get from the Scottish Parliament, to trigger a second referendum on Scottish independence to be held sometime between the autumn or the fall of 2018 and the spring of 2019. So this crisis is developing. It shows no sign of abating anytime soon. And with the polls now showing 50% support or almost 50% support for Scottish independence in Scotland, it's all to play for. And we could actually be looking at not only Britain coming out of the EU, but Britain no longer being Britain, or the UK no longer being the UK, and the end of a union that's been extant since 1707 with Scotland and the rest of the UK.
Help our US audience understand how the British system works. What is a devolved parliament? Talk about how this would be possible, that Scotland, a member of the UK, could actually secede. And how do the devolved parliaments evolve in the trajectory of British politics over the past decades?
Well, there's long been a democratic deficit in the UK. I mean, the UK is made up of four separate entities: England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, which is a partitioned six counties of the island of Ireland. And there's long been calls for home rule, for some kind of decentralisation of power to give Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland a say in their own futures, in their own politics, rather than have everything centralised from Westminster. So, for example, in the past, we would have a Secretary of State for Scotland would be appointed by a Westminster government. And given the huge contempt and disdain for the Tories in particular in Scotland, which is a hangover from the years of Thatcher, who deindustrialised large swathes of the UK, including Scotland, which was once known as the workshop of the workshop of the world, massive coal industry, massive shipbuilding industry, steel industry, these were all decimated, then the Tories have got almost zero support in Scotland, to the point where they only have one member of parliament in Scotland right now, out of all the different members of parliament who represent Scottish electoral constituencies. So there's a huge democratic deficit. And so in order to try and address that, when Blair came into power in the 1990s, in 1997, one of his first priorities was to approve the establishment of devolved parliaments, Scotland, a Welsh Assembly, and a Northern Ireland Assembly. And so these came into being in the late 1990s. And so these parliaments have what's called devolved powers. over certain issues, such as housing, such as healthcare, a variety of local issues. The big issues, no, foreign policy, defence, taxation, but they've now allowed some taxation policies to be devolved. And so as part of that process, in the Scotland Act, this is specifically with to do with the Scottish Parliament, there is something called Section 30, which allows Westminster to devolve so-called reserve powers that Westminster has to Scotland, one of those being the right to secede from the rest of the UK. And it was this Section 30 that was actioned by Westminster under David Cameron to allow the first referendum on Scottish independence to take place in 2014. And so when Nicola Sturgeon goes to the Scottish Parliament, gets approval, which she will, because there's a majority of pro-independence MSPs, members of the Scottish Parliament there just now, then she will seek another Section 30 from Westminster. Now, Theresa May, who's the current Prime Minister, has the right constitutionally to block it and say no. But if she were to do that, she would make Scotland well nigh ungovernable, and she would only be committing political suicide, because support for Scottish independence would go through the roof. So it's all to play for. And now Nicola Sturgeon has taken the initiative. She's tried to seek some kind of deal whereby Scotland would retain its membership of the European single market, upon which 300,000 Scottish jobs depend. Scottish investment into Scotland depends, and also for societal and cultural reasons. Scotland is predominantly pro-migrant, it's pro-refugee, whereas south of the border, there's a more ugly right-wing current when it comes to migrants. And so this kind of schism has developed in the context of Brexit. And so Nicola Sturgeon, as I say, has taken the initiative, and it's now a case of who blinks first. And Theresa May now has just added to her entry with regards to all the different pressures she's under, because she's refused to countenance any deal with Scotland to enable Scotland to remain in the single market, despite the fact that 62% of people in Scotland who voted at the EU referendum in June 2016 voted to remain in the EU. So clearly that democratic deficit must be addressed.
Talking about Theresa May, her office released a statement that read, "Another referendum would be divisive and cause huge economic uncertainty at the worst possible times. The Scottish government should focus on delivering good government and public services for the people in Scotland." Could you make the point about process? The devolved parliament in Scotland could approve it. It will approve the idea of an independence referendum. Theresa May in Westminster, the central authority, could stop it. You're saying she won't stop it because it would make Scotland, in your words, ungovernable. In other words, it would be considered such a flagrant intrusion or act of domination over Scotland that it would never be accepted, even by people who might vote no in an independence referendum. They would be too insulted by that.
Yes, absolutely correct.
But this would signal to me then perhaps something else from Theresa May, which is not trying to stop it, but trying to start the campaign now against a Scottish independence referendum, indicating or trying to suggest to the voters that there might be very, very, very big negatives that might befall Scotland should it leave the UK. And you can see this from, as we would start to imagine it or envision it, it could happen on numerous fronts. Last time around, the independence referendum, which was thought to be close, was actually handily defeated. Do you think it'll be different this time?
Well, in 2012, when the prospect of Scottish independence referendum was muted by the SNP then, support in the polls for independence was sitting at around 28%. And 2014, 45% of people who voted at the referendum voted to secede. And so now the polls are starting at a base figure of around 49, 50%. Obviously, we need to know what's going to happen. You can't just win these major issues and referenda, which, as I say, will end a union that has been extant for over 300 years by idealism alone. Moral argument is not enough. So the economic argument is key. And then the Scottish National Party's, the Yes Campaign's case for independence, its white paper in 2014, there were many, many deficiencies. It was not bold enough. They advocated, for example, retaining sterling, the British currency, or the UK currency, as the new independent Scottish currency, which would have meant transferring key economic levers, the power over key Scottish economic levers to a foreign central bank, the Bank of England. And that would have been, in the words of Gordon Brown, the former Prime Minister, that would have been tantamount to voting to become a colony of England rather than seceding from England. And that was a salient point. Also, there was issues with regards to the focus on oil prices. Oil prices, as we know, have collapsed in the last few years. And so that's unsustainable as well. But what's going to be key? The key thing is Scotland will need assurances from Brussels with regards to its future membership of the EU becoming automatic should it secede from the UK in these circumstances. And we're hearing reports that a spokesperson from the European Commission had just come out and said if Scotland was to secede, it would have to reapply like any other putative member state, i.e. it would not get special privileges. And if that is the case, then that would be a very big impediment to the vote being taken, because that assurance, if it's not there, then people will be wondering how is Scotland going to survive economically, given the parlous state of the last case for independence on oil prices. That will not alone suffice. And if the EU is coming out with this position, then that's a very big mistake on their part as well, because as we know, the EU is also in crisis. Centrifugal forces are popping up all over the EU, all over in Holland and Hungary and in Poland, in Germany, in France. The right is on the march. And so you would think that the EU would go out of its way to give these assurances to a putative, independent Scotland becoming an automatic member of the EU in order to try and forestall a precedent whereby the EU is in danger of breaking up itself.
Right. But let me just ask you then about the politics. If they're not giving a guarantee to Scotland that they have automatic entry, in other words, Scotland would have to, in the transition, apply to become a member of the EU. Then the EU and its economic commission, the big bankers actually from Northern Europe, would also start to dictate terms. There would be the issue of what would the currency be? Would the currency in Scotland then be the euro if it wasn't a sterling? Of course, the EU has very strict, as Greece knows, very strict positions regarding deficits, or at least deficits for some, and can, in fact, impose austerity. I mean, there would be lots of new issues that Scotland, which said we prefer to remain in the EU as part of the UK, would now, this would be a whole different ball of wax, though, if Scotland's coming to the EU not as part of the UK or remaining in as part of the UK, but as starting over.
Absolutely. There's huge challenges involved. But considering the pace at which events are evolving, 2 years down the line is a long time. And who knows what's going to happen with regards to the political architecture of the EU. The EU clearly needs to reform. It's a neoliberal banker's ramp. It operates in the interests of the banks, of the financial industry, and of big business. That has to change. And if the EU isn't prepared to change, then it itself, its own existence is threatened. So, yes, things may change, but if they don't change, then huge impediments lie in the way of Scotland winning this vote or the Yes campaign winning the vote for Scottish independence. But here's the thing, Brian. This is about democracy. And whether or not it's up to the people of Scotland to determine their own future, given the material change in circumstances between 2014, when the first referendum vote was taken, and now in the context of Brexit. So Nicola Sturgeon is basically saying the Scottish people deserve a say on Brexit, on whether they want to remain in the UK that is intent on taking us off the cliff of a hard Brexit, which is what Theresa May and the British government is doing, with its triggering of Article 50, with no amendments, with no deal, with no caveats on single market access, on the rights of EU citizens, etc., etc. And so this is just about democracy. The Scottish people will have all the facts, all the information in front of them, and it's up to them to make that decision. In terms of winning this vote, if there is no automaticity given from Brussels with regards to Scotland's future membership of the EU, then the Yes campaign, Nicola Sturgeon and others, the Scottish government and others who support Yes, will have to make that argument on a different basis. And whether they can or not will determine whether they succeed.
Is there any risk for her, for Sturgeon, under these circumstances? Because perhaps she feels compelled, given what happened with the referendum, where the vast majority in Scotland voted to remain, but England voted to leave. In other words, is the independence referendum offered under these very, very complicated, difficult, challenging circumstances by the Scottish Party. Is it perhaps sort of shadow boxing? In other words, going through sort of a ritual because she needs to in order to say, well, let the people decide, even if she might not think it's going to win?
I think you've called it absolutely right. I don't think this is a timing that Nicola Sturgeon would choose, nor circumstances. I believe her hand has been forced by the obduracy of Westminster, of the government of Theresa May, and refusing to countenance any deal. Because the question, the position that Theresa May has put to Scotland is that you are only viewed by us, by the Tories, which has long been the case, as a region within the UK rather than a partner nation of the UK. And it's that salient point that has been grappled over here. Is Scotland a nation? If it's Scotland's a nation and it has a right to decide its own future, the people in Scotland have a right to decide its own future on these seismic issues. We're not just talking about a change in tax policy. We're talking about fundamental constitutional change that could have a deleterious impact on the Scottish economy, on our culture, on our society. And so Nicola Sturgeon's hand has been forced. And you're right, this could also be a vote on her own credibility. She's hugely popular. But as you know, Alex Salmond was hugely popular. And he was a leader when Scotland, when the Yes campaign lost the referendum in 2014, and he resigned the day after. So Nicola Sturgeon is obviously gambling on that, but I think she has no choice. And I have to say, I believe that she is the only leader of the mainstream political parties in the UK who has emerged from this Brexit crisis with any degree of credibility, the way that she's tried to steward Scotland throughout this morass, and navigate the rapids of this, as I say, unfolding crisis that's been driven by the right and the ugly politics of xenophobia, nativism, and atavistic British nationalism.
Okay, we're going to leave it right there. We've been talking with John White. He's a political commentator, a political analyst, and he is the host of Radio Sputnik's weekly show, Hard Facts. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. A deepening diplomatic crisis between Turkey and several European governments, including the Netherlands, continues. As rallies are banned and accusations of Nazism fly, how far will this escalate? We are joined in studio by Walter Smolarek. He is the producer of this show, Loud and Clear. Welcome back, Walter.
Good to be here.
Thank you for joining. Turkish President Erdogan said yesterday, Mrs. Merkel, why are you hiding terrorists in your country? Why are you not doing anything? Mrs. Merkel, you are supporting terrorists. Now, he's talking about, of course, the leader of Germany. Why is Erdogan being so belligerent? I mean, here we have Germany, Walter, and Turkey, both member states of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the U.S.-led military alliance that has been dominant in European politics and in Turkish politics since 1945. What's going on?
Yeah, the rhetoric is really quite unbelievable. So what Erdogan is referring to is a string of events, some of which took place in Germany, where Turkish officials, high-ranking Turkish officials like cabinet members, were scheduled to address rallies to be attended primarily by members of the Turkish diaspora to encourage a vote in favor of the reforms to the constitution that Turkey will vote on April 16th. And so these reforms would basically create like an executive presidency in Turkey. Turkey right now has an executive prime minister and a largely ceremonial president, but Erdogan is term limited out of the prime ministerial role. He was the prime minister between, I believe, 2002 and 2004, since this most recent election. But he wants to concentrate all the executive, much of the executive decision-making power of the state in the presidency, which he will occupy, you know, perhaps into the mid-2020s if the term limit rules are approved. So he is counting on a strong showing of support among Turks living abroad and is obviously extremely furious and I think for electoral reasons really trying to inflame the conflict to portray himself as, you know, the victim and the defender of the Turkish nation because these speeches were canceled.
Let's talk about the Turkish diaspora in Germany. It's big. That's a lot of people. People who have come generation after generation after generation. Are they Turkish citizens? Are they German citizens? Are they both?
Yeah, so they hold Turkish citizenship, or many hold Turkish citizenship, but of course there are many who have also become German citizens. I mean, it's like any other immigrant population, and the people who have Turkish citizenship can vote in the Turkish election. And, you know, Erdogan is saying, you know, they don't want you to come out to vote. They're putting up all these obstacles in your way, but you have to. You have an obligation to, you know, show them that we're a proud people. And of course, he hopes that they vote in favor of the constitutional reforms. So the Turkish population of Germany has been a target of xenophobic right-wing racism. It's part of this, you know, general trend of the rising far right all across Europe. There was a far right wing, I guess you could call it a movement, you know, in the sense that it was primarily focused on organizing street activities called Pegida, the movement to stop the Islamization of the West. So they've organized anti-Islam demonstrations, and because Turks, I believe, are the largest ethnic group within the German Muslim population, they've borne the brunt of a lot of that. So that's the dynamic. In addition to Pegida, we should also note that there's the Alternative for Germany, the AfD party, which is rising in the polls rapidly. They might come in third place in the German federal election that's going to be taking place later this year. So that's also a concern.
And how would you characterize them politically?
Well, they're certainly a far right party. I mean, I would probably not go so far as to say it's like a fascist party, but like Golden Dawn in Greece, for instance. But I mean, they certainly are like, you know, the National Front in France, maybe, or UKIP in the United Kingdom. They began not necessarily as like an openly like xenophobic nationalist party. They were sort of a more economically focused party that was opposed to the Eurozone, so the use of the euro currency, because they thought it was basically a bad deal for Germany that Germany was subsidizing the weaker EU member states, which is not true. I mean, Germany is looting and plundering the countries of the European Union periphery. But that was the starting point. But they found, as far right-wing parties emerged or, you know, grew rapidly across the continent, that if they were to sort of fill that which had previously been unfilled space in German politics, they would have the possibility of exploding, their popularity exploding, which has in fact happened.
We're also seeing in this instance and all over Europe the case of competing nationalisms. And there's a toxicity to these kind of competing nationalisms that even though there is the NATO alliance and there is the EU, there is a rising tide of nationalism, and the tide of nationalism inside of Europe has both xenophobic, racist, anti-immigrant characteristics. In the case of Turkey, Erdogan is also trying to play the card of nationalism with Turks living, say, in Germany, in France, in Netherlands, who can vote in the upcoming referendum. And the referendum is in Turkey, or perceived by Turkey, at least perceived by the opponents of the referendum, as a power grab by Erdogan. In other words, an attempt to allow Erdogan to not only consolidate personal power following the July 15th failed coup d'etat, not only to consolidate his control over the courts, and many judges have been sent to prison, not only control over the media and many journalists have gone to prison, but it's also an attempt to both Islamicize the country, in other words, to do away with Turkey's traditional secular institutional priorities, which have been true since the Ataturk Turkish Revolution in the early 1920s. And at the same time, Erdogan, having been beset by crisis after crisis after crisis in Syria with a coup d'etat, with the migrant crisis, poverty, with all of the problems that Erdogan has faced, now Erdogan is going to lose that referendum, perhaps, and he requires the votes of the Turkish citizens living in Europe to vote. And now if he can create a nationalist backlash against Turkey, that perhaps consolidates the vote for him, even by people who may otherwise not support Erdogan, but on the basis of Turkish pride or Turkish dignity or rejection of racism. I mean, it kind of plays into the right-wing agendas of all the different players here.
Yeah, it really does. And that's an interesting point, because it really does look like it's going to be quite close, the referendum result. I mean, that's not at all what Erdogan wants. Erdogan was hoping for, you know, a resounding renewal of his mandate with like an overwhelming yes vote to the constitutional reforms. So, you know, and in the internal dynamics of like the Turkish electorate, the voting bloc that seems to be most up for grabs, or perhaps would be decisive for Erdogan's victory if Erdogan is going to win this referendum, are the nationalist voters, like the voters who would usually vote for the political party MHP, which is the Nationalist Action Party, which is, you know, not necessarily, it doesn't have like the Islamist, political Islamist orientation that Erdogan's AKP does, but it is like a far right-wing Turkish nationalist party that has its roots actually in these far right anti-communist death squads called the Grey Wolves that existed, I believe, primarily in the 1980s. So the leader of the MHP is an ally of Erdogan. However, the leader of MHP is very unpopular within his own party, and the only reason why he still retains his leadership of that party is that Erdogan basically did him a favor and canceled the, or, you know, had the judicial authorities cancel the Congress where the current leader of the MHP would have been almost certainly voted out. And so, you know, even though the leadership of that party is with Erdogan and is supporting a yes vote in the referendum, their electorate may be less convinced. So by stoking up this nationalist fervor, and by the way, I didn't mention specifically the terrorists that Erdogan was accusing German Chancellor Angela Merkel of supporting, are Kurdish freedom fighters, or, you know, supporters of the Kurdish struggle for self-determination and autonomy or sovereignty or equal rights. And so Erdogan is turning to his old punching bag, to the Kurds. This is the same maneuver that he pulled after the inconclusive 2015 election, reigniting the war with the Kurds to boost the votes for his AKP party. So, you know, this is an old trick that Erdogan is trying to play again, and it's unclear if it will succeed.
So we have in Germany, according to the statistics I've seen, 2,700,000 Turkish people. Of those, perhaps 1.7 million are Turkish citizens. In other words, people who could potentially vote. In France, it's about 500,000 Turks. In Netherlands, Netherlands has got the third largest number of Turks in the Turkish diaspora. And that's about 372,000 Turks living in the Netherlands. Now, some of the Turks are Kurds, like in Germany, because the Kurds are Turkish citizens who also identify as a minority people with their own distinct language. But let's turn to the Netherlands, Walter, and talk about what's going on, because there is a rising tide of right wing. I don't know if you would characterize it as fascism, but certainly those forces are deep in this battle now with Erdogan. Again, these competing nationalisms where these different parties both benefit in a way from the political clash. Go ahead about the Netherlands.
Yeah, you know, the situation in the Netherlands is very fractured right now. You know, the traditional party system that, the Netherlands has always had many, many parties in their parliament, but it was dominated by, you know, a handful, maybe like three, that would actually have the possibility of leading a coalition government. And right now what's happened is that party system has essentially fallen apart. So the traditional center-right party, the Christian Democrats, and the Labour Party have all seen their popularity plummet. I mean, none more so than the Labour Party. The Labour Party is going to be reduced to basically a minor marginal party in this election if the polls are correct. And so what we've seen rise in its place, I mean, there are several, but, you know, the most prominent, the ones that's been getting the most attention, is the Party for Freedom, which is led by Geert Wilders, who is an extreme anti-Muslim bigot. I mean, he's called for mosques to be shut down, for the Quran to be banned. And in fact, he was convicted of criminal charges for inciting hatred by giving this extreme, disgusting anti-Moroccan speech. So the polls indicate that his party, more likely than not, will come in first place. I think it's highly unlikely that they'll be able to form a coalition under their leadership or even be invited to be part of another coalition, although, you know, we will see. But what it's had the effect of is pulling the entire Dutch political scene to the right. So this is, I thought this was pretty remarkable. I saw this in Al Jazeera the other day. And so Mark Rutte, who is the prime minister of the Netherlands, he said, We feel a growing discomfort when people abuse our freedom to cause havoc. Well, they came to our country because of this freedom. Act normal or get out. And he explained that acting normal means, not acting normal means refusing to shake hands or accusing normal citizens as racists. So basically, he, who is the leader of the nominally center-right party that's, you know, pro-European and for, you know, the responsible consensus line, he's actually, like, adopting the language of wielders in the far right. I mean, act normal or get out is, like, a pretty remarkably xenophobic slogan, in my opinion. And that's, I mean, that is what they're saying, the normal center-right.
So by borrowing the sort of storm from the right, the page from the right, the banners from the right, the slogans from the right, it's not dog whistles because it's pretty right out in the open, kind of blatant anti-Islamic racism or bigotry might be a better word to put it. He's competing with the far right party, with Wilder's party. And actually, under these circumstances, he may be able to capture that right wing xenophobic hatred of immigrants or hatred of Muslims and propel himself to victory. Walter, there are three big elections coming up in Europe. Of course, there's the Dutch elections, the one that we're talking about. Then there's France, and then there's Germany. I mean, everything could shift or be shifting in a major way because of the growing power of right-wing political parties. Talk about how what happens in the Netherlands might impact on France and how what happens in Netherlands and France might impact on Germany.
Yeah, I mean, in France, it looks like Marine Le Pen will make it to the second round. Marine Le Pen is the leader of the National Front Party, which is, you know, a far, far right party. I mean, under Marine Le Pen's stewardship, after she took over from her father, she's tried to sort of mainstream the party. Her father, for instance, is a notorious Holocaust denier. Marine Le Pen doesn't really do that so much. I mean, she's sort of more like, you know, trying to portray the National Front is the defender of, like, the traditional values of the French Republic. And so they are going to be facing most likely Emmanuel Macron in the second round of the French election, who used to be a member of the Socialist Party. He left the Socialist Party. And by the way, for, you know, our listeners in the United States, the Socialist Party of France is not a socialist party. I mean, they're, you know, think about, like, the Democratic Party since the Clinton wing took over. You know, they're sort of, like, very establishment centrist types. But Macron actually broke from the right. And so he's running as sort of like this centrist, moderate, sort of like above politics, anti-corruption candidate who is very friendly to the European Union, which has been the main target of the right wing's, you know, political campaigning against the European Union, because that opens, you know, in their language, the floodgates to, you know, immigrants coming into France, immigrants and refugees. And so they're sort of demagogically playing on people's fears, people's prejudices. And I think that, you know, it'll be enough to give the National Front the best showing that they've ever had. But I don't think it'll be enough, just looking at opinion polls and just the general temperature in French society. I don't think it'll be enough for the National Front to actually win the presidency.
You're making predictions about elections? I thought we agreed that we would never do that after November 2016. But I hear you. That was Walter Smolarek. He's the producer of this show, Loud and Clear. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. South Korean politics and the geopolitics of East Asia has been scrambled by the impeachment of ex-president Park Geun-hye. Will the next president pursue a thaw in relations with the North, the DPRK? We are joined from New York by Hyun Lee. She is a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea and the Task Force to Stop THAAD in Korea and Militarism in Asia and the Pacific. Welcome back, Hyun.
Hi.
Thank you for joining. Now that the president, President Park, has been officially impeached, what comes next? Tell us about the election that will be held.
Yeah, first let me just say the impeachment was celebrated by Koreans all around the world this weekend, all throughout the weekend. because it was a culmination of months of mass demonstrations by a broad movement that was truly representative of many different sectors of South Korean society, as well as Koreans overseas, even though the technical ground on which the Constitutional Court ruled unanimously to impeach the president was just solely on the political corruption scandal that she was involved in. What the South Korean people, the mass movement, was demanding her ouster for was basically saying no to her autocratic style of rule, her labor market reform initiatives, her jailing of labor leaders and opposition lawmakers. So this impeachment ruling was celebrated by Koreans around the world. Now, what happens next is South Korea must have another presidential election within 60 days. So that means probably early May. And barring any unforeseen circumstances, Moon Jae-in of the Liberal Minju Party is the front runner in that election, and he will most likely be the next president.
And the way it works in South Korea compared, say, to other places in Europe or in the United States, there's not a runoff. In other words, the top vote getter in the first round wins. Is that right?
That's right. That's correct. So it's Moon, basically, right now, it's basically Moon versus everybody else. There are several liberal candidates who are in the running, and then there are a couple of conservative party candidates also in the running. But Moon is really the front runner at this point.
I'm looking at a website called military.com. This is what it says. The ouster of South Korea's president ushers in an era of uncertainty for its longstanding alliance with the United States at a crucial time as the threat from North Korea is growing. So, Hyun Lee, is the threat from North Korea growing? Why would the ouster of a South Korean president by a constitutional means and by a unanimous decision of a constitutional court usher in an era of uncertainty for U.S.-South Korean relations? Talk about that.
Right. Well, I mean, it clearly has military officials in the United States worried and nervous about the current situation. But the threat from North Korea is not growing. North Korea has never threatened to attack the United States or South Korea. But I think what has the United States worried is that while the United States was not engaging North Korea for the past 8 years, North Korea has been developing its nuclear weapons program and has made significant strides as a means of deterrence against the U.S. nuclear threat. The United States continues to maintain its first nuclear strike prerogative against North Korea. And so understandably, North Korea has been developing its deterrence capability. And at the end of the Obama administration, many people in Washington were saying his policy of strategic patience had failed, that North Korea is not collapsing, though it might soon have the capability of test launching an ICBM that can reach the continental U.S. So this has people in the United States very worried. I think the other thing that is worrisome is the Trump administration's apparent disarray in terms of defining a foreign policy agenda in general, and in particular, North Korea. You'll remember Trump is notorious for not sitting in on those daily intelligence briefings. And he had basically given that responsibility over to his former National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, who has now resigned. He was the only person who was listening in on those intelligence briefings since November, and now he's gone. So there is a complete vacuum of leadership in terms of defining U.S. Foreign policy. So that, I think, also is reason for people wrangling their hands in Washington. And then in the midst of all of this, there could possibly be a complete change in politics in South Korea. Moon Jae-in, as I mentioned, who is the front runner for the next presidential election, he was the former chief of staff for former President Roh Moo-hyun, who was the president from 2003 to 2008, he really pushed forward the sunshine policy with North Korea. That was basically a policy of engagement with North Korea through cultural exchanges, economic cooperation, through dialogue with North Korea. So this really puts into question U.S. strategic interests in the region. And I think that's why certain people in Washington might be worried.
The Sunshine Policy heralds back to the Kim Dae-jung government's position. Kim Dae-jung was the president in the end of the 1990s. Kim Dae-jung was a liberal, had been a dissident, was considered to be pro-American in many ways, or had been provided protection by some parts of the American establishment when Kim Dae-jung was also targeted by the old South Korean military dictatorship. But he pursued the Sunshine Policy. Now, in June, I want to ask you this because it's kind of interesting, I think, for our audience to see the dynamism of politics. He was promoting the idea that there should be a thaw. The sunshine meant let the sun in, let have a normalization of relations with the DPRK. The Bill Clinton administration in its last year also took that up and began the process of normalization, or what appeared to be normalization, with DPRK. Madeleine Albright, then Secretary of State, went to Pyongyang. There were direct discussions with Kim Jong-il, the then leader of the DPRK. Now, I had been in DPRK in, I believe it was February 2001, and I asked some of the officials who were there, what did they think about Kim Dae-jung's sunshine policy? And they told me, oh, that's just another way of trying to carry out regime change. We don't want to have anything to do with it. They really denounced it, like in the fiercest terms. And these were in direct discussions that I was having with them at that time as a guest. And then 4 months later, they were helping to co-sponsor the historic June 5th, 13th and June 15th summit between North Korea and South Korea. In other words, while still publicly saying we reject the Sunshine Policy, obviously something was going on behind the scenes whereby a real profound change almost happened. I mean, almost was completed. It did happen, but it wasn't completed because George W. Bush trounced that policy when he came in 2001. Do you sense a dynamism like that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there are two camps of people who seek regime change in North Korea. Without a doubt, officials in Washington, D.C. and in South Korea, their agenda is regime change in North Korea. But there are two camps. There are the hawks who want to do it through military action and allowing South Korea to absorb North Korea. And then there's another camp that wants to do it more sort of through soft power, through engagement, by opening up its markets, basically introducing a neoliberal agenda in North Korea and trying to change their economic and political system that way. So Kim Dae-jung presumably was of the latter camp. And you're right, his sunshine policy was really about, you know, I think he talked about the analogy of if you shine the sun on this country, then people have, you know, it becomes so warm that people have to start taking off their armors. And so that was his agenda. It seems like, you know, not only North Korea, but Koreans, both in the North and the South, progressives and in overseas, people who have been fighting for peaceful reunification of the Korean Peninsula for decades, really took this opportunity as a challenge to push forward a different kind of agenda. So the 2000 summit between the leaders of North and South Korea that happened, that was a historic moment where they came up with the June 15th declaration, which was an agreement that basically said we are going to strive for peaceful reunification without foreign intervention through reconciliation and cooperation among Koreans in the North, South, and the overseas. And this was a completely different kind of a reunification agenda, not one side absorbing the other, not expecting the other side to collapse or change, but really respecting the sovereignty of both sides through what they call the confederation model. Unfortunately, this policy was carried through by the subsequent Nomuyen administration, but it was abruptly ended in 2008 when the conservative Lee Myung-bak administration came in to govern in South Korea, and then subsequently Park Geun-hye. And so for the past decade, inter-Korean relations have been really tense. And now with the potential election of Moon Jae-in as the next president, there is an opportunity for a different kind of a policy.
Moon Jae-in said this recently: "We must embrace the North Korean people as part of the Korean nation. And to do that, whether we like it or not, we must recognize Kim Jong-un as their ruler and as our dialogue partner." Now, again, that would scare some elements in the U.S. military-industrial complex who only want tension, who only want confrontation, who only want hostility, who use each and every point of confrontation and hostility as a pretext or a rationale for something else that's in their agenda, like the deployment of THAAD, which not only threatens Koreans in North and South, but also threatens people in China and the government of China and Russia and others. Those kind of words, the idea that we must embrace the North Korean people and recognize Kim Jong-un, that's really going in a far, far different direction than what the current, you know, now impeached president was going. Now, Rex Tillerson is racing off to Korea right now, or he'll be arriving this week. How do you think it's playing out inside the Trump administration? Could it be that some people see in this the possibility of having some cover, some political cover, to actually begin meaningful negotiations with DPRK if a new incoming South Korean government says, in essence, that that's what they want? Or do you think, on the other hand, the U.S. will be working overtime to try to stop this process from coming to fruition?
Yeah, what is happening in the Trump administration is really the mystery to me. I think State Secretary Rex Tillerson is in Asia mainly to do damage control, to assess what is happening now after Park Geun-hye's impeachment. I doubt that it has much more meaning than that. What truly worries me is, you know, the report in the Washington Journal a few weeks ago where they reported that the Trump administration is going through an internal White House review of U.S. strategy on North Korea. And the way that they're going about doing this is basically they convened a meeting with national security officials across the government and basically asked them for their proposals on North Korea. And they said all options are on the table, ranging from taking military action to actually recognizing North Korea as a nuclear state. So basically anything goes, and that these ideas are supposed to be somehow organized into some rational menu of options and then put forth to Trump for a final decision. This has me worried because, you know, this is not how you define foreign policy. This is what you do when you have no idea what you're doing. You say, oh, let's have an open democratic process. Everybody gets a say. But if nobody in the room is informed enough about USDPRK relations, then obviously you can't produce a sound strategy. And like I said, the only person who has been privy to those regular intelligence briefings in the Trump administration with Michael Flynn, who is now gone. So, you know, the review process is supposed to lead to some sort of a decision on U.S. policy on North Korea this month. But, you know, I am truly worried about what that might mean. Hopefully it's part of their calculation that there is going to be a political change in South Korea. And I think that's probably why Tillerson is there, is basically to sort of understand the situation.
In our last 90 seconds or so, I want to ask you about the national security law. What is it, and is it possible under a liberal government, if Moon Jae-in and the Minju Party come to office, is it possible that the national security law could either be done away with or at least softened? Talk about it real quick.
We should certainly hope so. I mean, it's an archaic law that dates back to the 1940s. It basically criminalizes people who possess books that praise North Korea, has contact with anyone from North Korea without government approval, criminalizes people who express anything that can be construed as sympathy towards North Korea. It's historically been used by past dictators to repress dissent, especially those who promote reunification of the peninsula. Unfortunately, it was left on the books by the liberal presidents Kim Dae-jung and Roh Moo-hyun. And I think Moon Jae-in's first order of business when he gets into office is to basically abolish the national security law, because not having done that in the previous liberal administrations really got us into trouble in the subsequent conservative administrations.
I hear you on that. I know when I have visited South Korea that many people I met had been imprisoned, had been held in solitary confinement, had in fact been tortured for long periods of time just because of speaking out or standing up or expressing viewpoints or having a book. In other words, the U.S. says North Korea is the arch enemy of democracy, but the national security law is an enemy of democracy. It needs to be done away with. We have been speaking with Hyun Lee in New York. She is a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea and the Task Force to Stop THAAD in Korea and Militarism in Asia and the Pacific. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.